Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Great news for iPhone users may turn out to be bad news for AT&T. Verizon is on the way. Cupcakes are where it's at in the stock market. Seriously. And what if all the tea in China were coffee? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as online savings account and money market account. Learn more at AllyBank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 10th of January. Good to have you with us. After the weekend's events in Arizona, this is not a day when corporate profits and stock markets are the top of the news. The political business of the country has paused, at least for now. But the corporate economy does keep going. And so after years of speculation and a firm AT&T monopoly, Verizon is expected to unveil its own version of Apple's iPhone sometime tomorrow. We've called John Moe to talk things over with us. He's the host of the Marketplace Tech Report. John, good to have you here.
Hey, Kai.
So I'll tell you, there was no small cheer that went up around the conference table this morning when we started talking about this story. and we'll get to the joys of Verizon having an iPhone in
yes.
a minute. But what does this mean for AT&T?
It's a sense of foreboding, Kai, I think, is what's happening with AT&T. They've got a lot of people locked up already to those two-year contracts. You know, when the iPhone 4 came out last summer and there was all those mobs of people waiting to buy them, AT&T sees those mobs as just all these wonderful two-year contracts just sitting
That's
out
right.
there. So they have that revenue to depend on. They've also locked in the Windows Phone 7, lots of Blackberries and Androids are on AT&T. So they've bought themselves a little bit of time, good year and a half, couple years maybe, mm-hmm. to kind of turn things around either in terms of the quality of their network or in terms of the perception that their network's really lousy. So right now, it's they're on the clock, basically.
And there's the rub, John, right? Because AT&T has been hammered for having this slow data network, and now Verizon is presumably going to be better?
Verizon says they're going to be better. They've been talking the talk for a while now that when this happens, they'll be ready to go, that they can withstand the traffic. You know, and they have a point. They've been handling lots of Android traffic. They've had the iPad for a few months now, and things are evidently going okay. But, you know, what's going to happen is when the Verizon iPhone really takes off, we're going to find out who the winner is. If it starts to crash, if it starts to tumble, then Verizon's in some trouble and AT&T looks not so bad.
There are rumors about Verizon offering an unlimited data plan in contrast to AT&T that's got these tiered things. Is that what you're hearing?
That's what I'm hearing. Yeah, that's what I'm seeing a lot of places. The idea is it would be a $30 a month data plan, which is a little bit more expensive than the basic lower tier of the AT&T tiered data plan. I also think, you know, as a promotional offer, as a get you in the door offer, it's a pretty shrewd bit of marketing because it's that sort of a cocky Verizon's way of saying, oh, yeah, traffic, we can handle traffic. Don't worry about us and traffic. We'll give you all that you need for $30 a month.
What if you are Sprint and T-Mobile today? Are you just sitting there saying, drat, they got away?
I gotta think so.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're Sprint or T-Mobile, you're not going to have the iPhone. And a lot of people have said, once Verizon gets the iPhone, that's the phone I really want. And so all of a sudden, if you're one of the other carriers, then you're one of the other carriers. And you don't have the big status symbol. So, and you don't have all the revenue to build up your signal and build up your infrastructure that comes with those contracts.
John Moe, he's the host of the Marketplace Tech Report. You can hear more from that show on our website. It's marketplace.org. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, a mixed response, you might say. Corporate profits have started trickling out, and traders have started placing their bets on some big economic news coming out later this week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here in California, Governor Jerry Brown has jumped from the frying pan of a political campaign into the realities of our budget fire. The governor released his proposed budget this morning. $12 billion in spending cuts, all told. Low-income Californians are going to see a lot of cuts in welfare and social services, and health care for the poor are all going to be trimmed. The governor is also going to ask voters to do something they have resisted for years now, raise taxes. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
In outlining his proposed cuts, Governor Brown didn't do much to sugarcoat California's budget mess.
What I propose will be painful. It's going to take sacrifice from every sector of California.
Some state employees will see pay cut by 8 to 10%. If the cuts go through, they could have implications beyond California.
Other states are going to be very interested to see, is this successful in California on top of the cuts that have already taken place?
That's Scott Pattison, executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officers. He says other states will also be closely watching California's plan for a special election in June. Voters would be asked to approve a five-year extension of the state's current income and sales taxes.
If there are states like California that are successfully able to extend tax increases or even add tax increases, that's going to be of great interest to other states.
That may be a long shot. Robert Ward is deputy director of the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government.
California is the clearest example of a state where voters want to have it both ways. They want to have high levels of spending on education, for example, but they also want to have low taxes.
It remains for Governor Brown to convince Californians that more taxes would be good for them. If Brown can pull that off, expect other states to follow his lead. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy brings his campaign for greater stability in food prices and global currencies to Washington this week. Sarkozy met with President Obama today, trying to get the United States to sign on to his priorities as head of the Group of 20. Those meetings are going to be in France later this year. And the French and some other Europeans have another thing they want to get done, too, one that doesn't necessarily involve getting American support. They're talking about revamping the way gross domestic product is measured, that granddaddy of all economic indicators. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Robert F. Kennedy once said GDP measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. GDP gives us the market value of goods and services countries produce every year, but little else. Carol Graham is a Brookings Fellow. She says the recession and a big push from Sarkozy and British Prime Minister David Cameron have made the GDP makeover debate legit.
The fact that there was a pretty major session at the American Economics Association on beyond GDP, which 10 years ago would have been impossible, is already a sign of where the debate is.
Critics of GDP say it's a limited tool. A spike in gasoline consumption, for example, is good for GDP, but may mean dirtier air and traffic. But Graham thinks measuring things like happiness goes too far.
I don't think we have enough agreement on what happiness is.
But Britain, France, and Canada all want to start measuring well-being, if not happiness. That means factoring in things like health and leisure time. Stanford economist Peter Klinau warns it won't be easy.
When we're looking at stuff like leisure, we're really worried that there are differences in preferences across people within an economy, definitely. But even, I mean, it's even conceivable, you know, if people develop different languages in different countries, why can't they develop different preferences for how much time they work versus how much time they spend with their family?
The new formula is likely to be a separate index that complements rather than replaces GDP, and it could better indicate, as Robert Kennedy hoped, whether we are proud to be Americans. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
All right, so now on to something a little bit sweeter, cupcakes. You may have noticed that they have moved way beyond the school bake sale. Crumbs, that's a high-end cupcake bakery out of New York, said today it's going public. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has the skinny on whether cupcakes are the next big thing or the next big bubble.
Cupcakes are starring in two TV shows. They had a cameo on Sex and the City. They went from kids' birthday parties to weddings. There are gourmet cupcake shops all over the country. And now, cupcakes are going to Wall Street.
You know, who doesn't love a cupcake, right?
Andrew Freeman runs a marketing company for the hospitality business. He says fancy cupcakes may be expensive, but in a recession, they can be an affordable guilty pleasure because people still want to feel decadent.
So I'm going to splurge the $4 on the cupcake, which in relative terms is probably like taking a little mini vacation.
If your idea of a mini vacation is a 4-inch tower of butter and sugar, Crumbs, which sold 13 million cupcakes last year, has big plans for its little cakes. 200 stores across the country. Sam Yake follows retail food companies at BGB Securities. He says it can be hard for a company to maintain its quality and its cachet when it expands quickly. The donut company Krispy Kreme, for example, has had a tough time since it went public 10 years ago. He says there's also a risk cupcake eaters could get their fill.
I personally would be very reluctant to, you know, invest in that. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that has a faddish feel to it.
Freeman, the marketer, says places like Crumbs have to think about ways to expand within the genre by doing things like holding birthday parties, which is, of course, where all this started. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
New financial regulations are nibbling away at some of the most profitable and reliable sources of income that banks have. Rules for credit cards and overdraft fees have cut tens of billions of dollars out of their profits. Proposed regulations for merchant fees would cost them billions more. So maybe nibbled away wasn't the right phrase, and the banks aren't suffering silently. Instead, they've been finding new ways to make money, new fees, charging for things like checking accounts and paper statements. And that's hitting an already underserved segment of the financial population especially hard, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports from New York.
Things you can expect to pay a fee for this year: not having enough money in your checking account, not having multiple accounts with a bank, not doing your banking online. All of that could hit lower income customers especially hard, says Mike Mebs, an economist who advises banks.
They're basically shedding themselves of accounts that they can't make any money at.
Namely, the checking accounts of lower-income people. Those accounts used to generate a big chunk of overdraft fees, says Sarah Ludwig, co-director at the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project in New York. She says now that new regulations limit overdraft, banks are aiming fees at lower-income customers.
The new round of fees that we're seeing by the large banks definitely fall disproportionately on lower-income people.
Ludwig says her organization has spent years encouraging clients to use bank accounts instead of relying on check cashing and pawn shops, but new fees will make that harder.
So now we've got people who are told over and again you should have a bank account, that that's the responsible thing to do, that that's the safe thing to do, having to face the fact that it can be quite prohibitive to do that banking with them.
Ludwig says that will drive lower-income people out of the banking system.
Now we've got the further perpetuation of a two-tiered credit system where we have a separate, unequal system serving higher-income people from the one serving lower-income people, and this new round of fees is just going to push more low-income people out of the banking system and continue that bifurcation.
Which is what the banks ultimately want, says bank consultant Ken Thomas.
Banks cannot put a sign in the window that says, you know, we will give better service and charge lower fees to rich people. They can't do that. So they tier their products, their pricing, to have the same effect.
Bank economist Mike Mebs expects we'll see lower income customers leaving bigger banks for cheaper options like credit unions. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, what Starbucks has wrought.
China's increasingly on-the-go urban population means that demand for coffee in the home of the world's oldest tea culture is higher than ever.
But first, let's do the numbers. A couple of big deals and European economic woes weighed on the markets today. The Dow Industrials shed 37 points, about one-third of 1%, closed at 11,637. The S&P 500 fell a point, a tenth percent, ended things at 1,269. Only the NASDAQ rose, clicked up 4 points, almost two-tenths percent, finished at 27.07. The one spark of excitement for investors was the imminent debut of Apple's iPhone on Verizon that we told you about. Apple share shot up nearly 2%. Verizon closed basically flat. But get this, AT&T, which will lose that monopoly, as we mentioned, dialed down 1.75%. Also, shares of Sprint sank 2.1% today. For-profit colleges failed big time. Strayer Education forfeited 22% after reporting a sharp decline in new enrollment. Apollo Group, the biggest for-profit educator by market value, sank more than 5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.29%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for the month of November. The National Oil Spill Commission releases its final report, Deepwater, the Gulf Oil Disaster, and the Future of Offshore Drilling. And on January 11, 1973, the American League adopted the designated hitter rule, allowing an additional player to bat for the pitcher. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So a couple of years ago, the fence in our yard was broken, the one that goes around the house and keeps the dogs in. And I thought to myself, I could just fix it myself or I could pay somebody to do it. Life's busy. Nobody has a lot of time. But fences are expensive. So I did it myself for basically just the cost of materials. No big deal. But that little cost analysis I did is something all of us do all the time. It's also the basis for Eduardo Porter's new book, The Price of Everything. Eduardo, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Kai.
You know, it struck me as I was reading this book that it's about price, sure, but it's really about price in the broadest possible sense. It's almost about value, right?
Well, yes, although value is a kind of like a shiftier concept, right? I do agree with you that this isn't price as in money price. Price can be measured in many other ways, including in time, in work, in love. In fact, I like to think of the best way of measuring price as in terms of opportunity. The price of any choice that you take is all the other things that you did not do because you took this path. That's the opportunity cost.
So how do we weigh and apply this price concept, you know, every day? I mean, is there a basic answer?
Consider how you shop. There was this study done of shoppers in Denver a few years ago, using a database by a market research firm that had, you know, thousands of families. They had their data about their ages, their incomes, along with data on what they bought in supermarkets and how much they paid for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they sifted through this data, and they found that families that earned $70,000 a year or more spent about 5% more for the exact same goods as families that earned like $30,000 or less. Why is this? Well, the price of the time of the more affluent families was higher than for the less affluent families. Say you're a janitor that earns $11 an hour, right? And somebody comes and offers you $100 or an extra hour of free time. Chances are you'll take the $100. But say you're a lawyer making $500 an hour and somebody comes with the same offer. Chances are you're going to take the time. That's because the value of your time is higher. And now when you move this to the grocery store, the janitor is going to clip coupons, is going to wait for specials, is going to keep an eye out on the best time to buy any given thing, do comparison shopping and so on, and therefore is going to get stuff for less than the lawyer who's just going to pick up, you know, whatever she needs without necessarily even looking at the price tag.
None of this pricing that you're talking about, whether it's the larger social issues or what we're paying for a house or a gallon of gas, none of that happens in a vacuum. It's always balanced against the worth of something else.
The history of how we understand prices is really very interesting because it goes back to the ancient Greeks. The notion of price was very attached to the notion of value, and which was kind of like a moral concept. And we go back to where we started this conversation. The idea that there had to be some morality to how much things were worth in the marketplace drove the understanding of prices, you know, until like the 17th century. This idea that there was some justice attached to the prices of things. And many people began to understand this as the work that was contained in any given object, right? That the price of that thing had to be the value of the labor that had gone into it. And this, you know, this was posited by David Ricardo and by Adam Smith. And it was, you know, perhaps most famously espoused by Marx. But it totally forgot the idea that actually the price of something in the marketplace is a transaction. I mean, there's a buyer who values something and a seller who will be willing to make that transaction at that given price or not.
And everybody has to be happy, right?
Well, with a grain of salt. The fact that we choose to make a transaction at a given price doesn't mean that under any circumstances we would be happy to make that transaction at that price.
Eduardo Porter is an editorial writer at the New York Times. He's also got a new book out. It's called The Price of Everything, Solving the Mystery of Why We Pay What We Do. Eduardo, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Opportunity cost or no, prices do sometimes make you wonder. You can see a list of some of the more unusual things that we pay for or don't pay for. They're on our website, marketplace.org. We've also got an excerpt of The Price of Everything, Eduardo Porter's new book, on our new book blog, The Big Book, it's called. You can find it at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Way out in the middle of almost nowhere in southwest China, farmers have been growing tea for thousands of years. Not just any tea either, but a variety known as Pu'er, one of China's most famous teas. But it's the other morning drink that's on the rise. Coffee consumption in China is growing about 25% a year. Starbucks has opened 400 stores in China there in the past decade. And so our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports tea farmers are setting their sights on the bean.
Xu Mei Ling pushes a wooden rake through a ton of coffee beans. They dry in the sun on a concrete slab in front of her tiny shack of a home in this tropical valley on the Chinese border with Burma. She began growing coffee 5 years ago, but she's never entertained the thought of drinking it.
It's way too expensive. I've heard it tastes bitter, so bitter that you have to add sugar. I have no idea how it tastes, and I don't want to taste it.
How's that for a ringing endorsement? The surly 44-year-old is better at business than PR. Like nearly everyone in this region, she's grown tea her whole life. But then she figured out she could make twice as much growing coffee. China's increasingly on-the-go urban population means that demand for coffee in the home of the world's oldest tea culture is higher than ever. More and more farmers in this tea-growing region are making the pilgrimage along this treacherous jungle road to the plantation of Liu Xiaogui. The short, mild-mannered farmer lives in this remote, lush valley of bamboo groves surrounded by steep hillsides of coffee trees. The 70-year-old hermit is the Jedi master of coffee growing in China.
Lately, I've had a lot of visitors. Farmers from all over the place are asking me to teach them how to grow coffee. They invite me to come to their farms, but I'm too old for that. I teach them here.
A farmer in training picks bright red beans nearby. In an international competition a few years ago, coffee from this region beat out Colombian coffee in quality. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz came here last month to announce the company would locate its first Chinese coffee farm in this region. Liao's excited, but he's looking even further ahead.
It's a pity that we have to sell our coffee to other brands. The reason we've worked with companies like Nestle and Starbucks here is to learn their skills, management, and brand building. One day, we'll have our own famous brand. Americans will even know who we are.
With all these converts to coffee in the tea industry's backyard, you'd think that tea companies would feel under siege. As Shen Youcai pours me a cup of tea at his company's plantation, his hand is not shaking. Shen points out the growing seasons for tea and coffee are different. This allows farmers to harvest both without a problem. Plus, says Shen, a beverage that's synonymous with thousands of years of Chinese culture is not likely to be supplanted by this muddy-looking foreign beverage.
Coffee is just a fad in China. In 5 or 10 years, everyone here will go back to growing tea. There's no way we feel threatened.
But Xu Mei Ling, the farmer who switched to coffee, says tea companies should take heed. She and other farmers here say it's common practice for big tea companies to take advantage of the region's impoverished and uneducated farmers by luring them to their plantations with promises of high salaries, only to trick them into signing 30-year contracts for wages they can barely live on.
That's why I started growing coffee. I control the price. The price of tea is going up, but we continue to make around an eighth of what it's worth. The plantation boss takes the rest. If we ask for a raise, he'll fire us.
No such raw deal growing coffee. Not yet, at least. She says growing coffee gives her more freedom. Her plan is to leave the tea plantation once she's saved enough from selling her coffee. And maybe one day, she says, she'll even try a cup. In Pu'er, China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Rob blogs about China for us as well. His Chinopoly blog has more on the disparities between plantation owners and farmers. Also, a slideshow of coffee and tea plantations over there. It's all on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at Putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in honor of the opening of corporate earnings season. Alcoa reported profits after the bell this afternoon, basically in line with expectations. Also reporting profits was the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. It's got all those treasury bonds it's been holding and loans the Fed's made under its various bailout or stimulus programs. Bottom line, in the most literal sense of the word, the Fed cleared almost $81 billion in profits last year. Almost all of that, $78 billion, is going to get sent to the Treasury Department for deposit in the general fund. The rest is what the Fed gets to use for operating expenses in the year to come. And on that note, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 37 points, a third of 1%, closed at 11,637. The NASDAQ rose, clicked up 4 points, almost 0.2%, 2707 at the bell. The S&P 500 off a point, 0.1%, ended things at 1269. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, is the motivation to go green really all about just making some green?
Yes. It's a tax grab. I don't want to say it's disguised, but it's palatable.
I think we should have cut the tape right there. Just yes. The Freakonomics of Trash on the broadcast tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.